This is Treasury Matters, the podcast from Alma. Each week through this series, we will be joined by a leading industry voice to talk all things Treasury. Joining Justin to talk about recovery and resolution is Kevin O'Donnell, who works in prudential risk for Skipton Building Society.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the next edition of Treasury Matters from the UK Asset Management and Liability Association. I'm your host this afternoon. My name, as ever, is Justin Fox. I'm Group Treasurer for Virgin Money, and I'm also the Chair of ALMA. And I'm really pleased this afternoon to introduce Kevin O'Donnell. Kevin, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Kevin O'Donnell. I currently work in prudential risk in the second line at Skipton Building Society. But prior to that, and the reason I've probably been invited on this podcast is very much the fact that I have been involved in recovery and resolution at both Virgin Money and indeed at Metro Bank prior to me joining Skipton.
And Kevin, I'm right in assuming you've just written a chapter on recovery and resolution for the SERP balm.
That's right. Through my experience at both Virgin and Metro in terms of pulling together the recovery plan and also the inaugural iteration of our compliance with RAF, I've then taken that knowledge and written the SERP balm chapter. So yeah, it was a good experience and good to relook at things from first principles basis and actually try and apply that real life knowledge into what the RAF and the recovery plan requirements are.
Thanks, Kevin. And just for listeners, RAF means Resolvability Assessment Framework. So that's the requirement set by the Bank of England. But we'll get into that in a minute. We've talked a lot in previous podcasts about the state of the world post the global financial crisis. And recovery and indeed resolution was one of the cornerstones that certainly regulators alighted on. Kevin, from your point of view, what is recovery and what is resolution in sort of simple terms?
As you just said there, Justin, it's a concept that came out in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, where a number of banks incurred very large losses and they needed bailouts from the taxpayers' money to prop up the balance sheets. And at that point, the phrase too big to fail came into being, whereby it felt that that the banks had become too big to fail. And indeed, in certain countries such as Ireland, bailing out of those banks put great strain on the national purses, and indeed right here in the UK as well. Since that crisis, the regulators have become much more proactive, intrusive in making sure that they've got contingency plans. That, for me, is what recovery is about. It's about contingency. When you hit a stress, have you got plans in place to actually pull yourself out of that and maintain that going concern? And also, the public authorities have developed new legal arrangements called resolution powers. So resolution, for me, is really going beyond that stress analysis, and it goes from being a going concern entity to a gone concern entity, and what you actually do to ensure that, one, the economy remains stable and safe, and two, those banks will no longer have a bailout, rather they'll have bail-in capital such that there won't be any impact on the taxpayers' money. So in summary, for me, is recovery is that really severe stress where if things continued the way you are, you would be looking at insolvency, but having contingency plans to pull yourself out of that. And then resolution is that if those recovery plans fail, then there are mechanisms in place such that the bank can resolve itself and actually put actions in place through the bail-in of MREL debt and other restructuring actions to make sure that the bank remains as viable in the long term as possible.
Yeah, I mean, when you and I have chatted about this in the past, I've always sort of said resolution is the state you pass into when the recovery actions that you've taken so far just aren't enough to persuade the market.
Yep.
And effectively, you need basically a hard reset.
Correct.
And almost a pause to enable much more difficult actions to be taken, which are more fundamental. But that aligns to the observation you made, you know, post GFC, regulators, but also governments were adamant that there is no public sector solution. There needs to be a private sector solution, which is why we have these plans. I mean, in the US, they're called living wills, but also importantly, we've issued a bunch of self-insurance in the form of MREL debt to provide that capability of a hard reset.
And you're actually spot on there about resolution being that hard reset. So if I think about recovery planning, you're talking about what can you do in the short to medium term to restore the strength of that balance sheet, whereas post-resolution is a much longer time frame, and that resolution event is almost that reset where you recapitalize through the bail-in of the MREL notes, and that then buys you time to make much more difficult decisions with regard to the shape of your balance sheet and what you want to do. So that could be much longer.
Just another question here. I mean, who does it apply to? Clearly, if we go back to the GFC, if you look in the UK at least, you had RBS, this classic example of you know, a bank that failed. It was the largest bank globally at that time. But equally, as I well remember, you had some small building societies that equally failed, the Dunfermline Building Society. So in your mind, what types of entities should be thinking about recovery and resolution plans?
For me, it is really institutions of all ranges and sizes. RAF, the Resolvability Assessment Framework, that was initially rolled out for the top 8 banks in the UK. It has subsequently been rolled out to the mid-tiers, so any of those banks or building sites that are required to hold MREL debt. Yep. But in terms of those resolution powers, you do have bail-in, but you've also got the liquidation and insolvency measures as well. That's much more prevalent for the smaller banks, whereby we've now, just in the past year or so, got solvent exit, where those smaller entities are having to actually think about how they would exit the market without having a knock-on impact on the economy.
So everybody should be thinking about this. Board should be thinking about this. Management teams should be thinking about this. And I guess, who owns it? I mean, you've worked at a couple of institutions. This is always a hot debate internally because it's a lot of work.
Yep.
And not everybody wants to take the responsibility. But in your mind, who owns it? And I'd like your thoughts on, within that ownership, what's the role of the three lines of defense in overseeing it?
I think the question of who owns it, I mean, at the end of the day, if a bank gets into trouble, who are the individuals that are going to need to take the decisions to recover and or resolve? So that is clearly the board, the CEO, the CFO. So in an actual crisis, I think we're actually quite clear that becomes the only thing that the board and the senior management is actually interested in. But when you're talking about recovery and resolution and us actually preparing in BAU, who owns that? I think that's a much more interesting conversation. So if I'm to break it down, what will break a bank? It will be lack of liquidity, as we've seen in a number of instances.
And we saw that really last year, right? In 2023 with SVB.
Correct.
Both in the US and indeed within the UK. It was a good reminder that liquidity can kill.
Yes, indeed. Liquidity can kill, and it can kill fast. I'm sure you've seen the report that came out today on SVB saying that they lost 85% of their deposits within 2 days.
Wow.
So it can kill you very, very fast. But another sense as well, you're talking about capital. So who owns the capital and liquidity? For most institutions, you'd think the treasurer. Therefore, what you're seeing is a lot of the BAU preparedness and ownership of the recovery plan, the RAF documentation, etc., is very much in the treasury space. And in fact, both at Virgin and at Metro, a recovery and resolution teams sat under the treasurer. The thing about it, though, is it's much more than that. It's about survival. It's about keeping the lights on. You're talking about the operational capabilities as well. So is there a role there for the COO in that, and making sure that we've got disaster recovery plans, business continuity planning, et cetera, to make sure that we can keep the operations going? And indeed, a lot of the modeling for any of the decisions, if you think about recovery and resolution on a stress continuum, it starts in a BAU world with your corporate plan, and that's generally owned by the finance teams. And any decisions that we make in recovery and resolution, how does that flow through to that business plan? So it's a very, very interesting question and a very difficult question to answer. I think because of that focus on capital and liquidity, I think the market has moved ownership of the recovery plan and the RAF preparations as treasurer with inputs from other areas of the bank or building society.
I'd agree. I mean, my experience, I was in charge of recovery planning at RBS and the Virgin Money, but it is that total firm approach that you need to take. You know, my argument when I talk about this internally is the entire leadership team of the bank owns the recovery and the resolution plan. And to be fair to the Bank of England, in the letters that they send out and the guidance they provide, they do remind firms that it's the entire leadership team. It's not just a finance thing. It's not just a treasury thing. I mean, we know because we've sat there, if you look at a lot of the barriers to recovery or resolution, they are balance sheet items. They generally sit within treasury, but you're talking about operational issues. You're talking about people issues. You may have legal issues. There are a whole host of things that you need to think about.
Yeah, completely agree. We may come on to it a bit later on, but in terms of that roles and responsibilities, who's responsible for what, and how do we actually ensure and test that we've got those capabilities? I think that that's one of the key things. So while that central coordination may be done in Treasury, it is very much a whole bank thing. As you say, operations, people, finance, et cetera, et cetera. And indeed the frontline business.
So how often do you think this needs to be produced? And I think keep in mind, what does the regulator expect? What do you have to do for the regulator? But what also represents good practice?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the regulations are quite clear. So it's interesting. Recovery planning is governed by the PRA here in the UK, and they stipulate that the recovery plan should be refreshed at least annually, and it's essential that it's kept up to date. So any sort of corporate actions, M&A activity, etc., we should always be having a look at the what that does to our recovery plan.
Can I jump in there?
Yeah.
So a good tip for people is every time you do something major at a corporate strategy level, if you're not thinking about the impact on recovery and resolution, you're missing a trick.
Very much so. And I think that comes out very, very clearly when you're speaking to the regulator. Resolvability assessment framework. So the RAF, that is under the auspices of the Bank of England. The rationale for that split is the PRA is very much on a going concern basis, whereas the Bank of England is on a gone concern basis. So it's not necessarily helpful given that recovery and resolution are so closely intertwined, but we do have different regulators. And the way the Bank of England have set up, how often does it need to be produced? So initially, when RAF came into being, the thinking would be that bigger banks would be on a 2-year cycle. And of course, the big banks just publicly announced their results back in August 2024. And the thinking there would be the mid-tiers. So people like your Metros and Skiptons, et cetera, would be in those off years. So again, on a 2-year cycle. But what was interesting when the Bank of England came out in August with that public announcement, they did say that the next cycle would be in 3 years' time for the larger banks. And indeed, with the publication of the consultation paper 1224 just a couple of weeks ago, they've actually wrote that into the regulations that 2-year cycle is not actually is removing that 2-year cycle. So for me, that's a good indication that one, the Bank of England is comfortable with progress that has been made, and now the things that need to happen for in RAF are so fundamental, they need a bit more time to actually give banks the time to actually implement those improvements and not take a lot of the resource out to produce a document to fit into that 2-year cycle. So I think it's recognition that we've come a long way, but there's still a lot to do. And it's about buying the time to actually make those improvements. I don't know what you're talking about.
I think that's a really good point, and it's something I think about a lot around, one, I would say all banks have made great progress in this area, and you saw the improvements that the large banks have made between the two submissions. Two, it's quite a mature process now, I think, within firms, but you're now in the sort of thornier issues around longer term change. And the big thing for me when we talk about this internally is aligning this with our broader change program.
Yep.
Because things like data quality and data initiatives, all those sorts of things have to be done in conjunction with a recovery and resolution mindset.
Yep.
But equally, we're spending time on other things, like, let's say, cyber or financial crime, that equally, if you're spending time and money investing in your capabilities there, you are reducing the risk that you get to these types of scenarios and have to pull the plan off the shelf and say, okay, we're now dealing with this. Is that how you think about it?
It is. And do you know something? You hit on something that's very, very pertinent to me at the moment. When you're talking about the BAU change programs, etc., for me, that is where we need to move to. Recovery and resolution, effectively, it's BAU operations in a stress. It's how you run your bank in a stress. And there will be situations where the lessons you get from recovery and resolution, planning and testing, will really, really benefit your BAU operations. And I think that's crucial for the ongoing improvement and actually letting the management committees and boards know that based on the lessons learned from this test, and if you invest in some of these changes to improve those capabilities, yeah, you actually improve your BAU capabilities as well. And I think that's really important for the future.
Yeah, we'll come to the future in a little bit. Let's go back to some of the more basic. One of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about is the interlinkage of recovery and resolution with other critical regulatory deliverables, so the ILAP, the ICAP, and for those large firms that participate, let's say stress testing, do you think they overlap, and is there a neat way to knit them all together, or is that just part of the conundrum that firms need to manage through and also work with the regulators on?
Yeah, I think the overlaps are huge, to be honest. If you think about the stress continuum, whereby you start off in happy land, we've got our BAU, we've got our corporate planning process. Most corporate plan processes actually look at some scenario testing, and that's then moving towards the stress in it, where the ILAP covers the liquidity stress and ICAP covers the capital stress. And so for me, there's overlap there. There's lessons to be done. And the ILAP and ICAP stresses that you create, they're severe but plausible. They're meant to really test the bank's capabilities and what options they've got in place and what management actions they can pull on. Yeah. And for me, recovery planning is just the next level down. It's things have got just slightly worse. We're further down the stress. Those initial management actions didn't quite have the impact we wanted them to. So what's next in the cards? What other options do we have available? And then further down that stress is resolution. So therefore, bringing into action, what options do we have that maybe didn't deliver what we needed in the time frames that we needed in recovery, but could actually deliver going forward? Interlinkage is absolutely massive. And what that means for me when we're talking about stress testing in the BAU world is you're talking about starting off with your corporate plan, stressing that to severe but plausible in both your ICAP and ILAP. Then you're moving to recovery, and where it's not just liquidity or capital, it's both liquidity and capital. So I think there's a lot of synergies in using that ICAP A scenario as a base and making it worse, and also overlaying those liquidity stresses that we talk about in the ILAP, and just see what happens when we've got both capital and liquidity. And then going forward into the resolvability world where you're looking at stressing your balance sheet to the point of non-viability. And actually, how do you actually get there? So I think there's quite a lot of synergies to be made when you're doing that stress test and keep layering on so the management committee understands where we're coming from.
The point you make about point of non-viability, you and I used to talk about this a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give you a crass analogy that was used with me very early on as to how to think about your stress testing for the recovery plan. But it then leads into a more important point. Is there a role around where firms think about their point of non-viability, and therefore what does that tell you for things like capital and liquidity targets? So the crass analogy that was given to me is that if you look at a recovery plan, what are you trying to do there? Well, imagine you're flying a plane and you get into turbulence and effectively you're falling. And the idea of the recovery plan is just before you crash is you're able to basically take back control and restore safety and take the plane back up again, right? You get to that point of failure in that scenario. But that's what it's been described as, is you get to the lowest point you can get to before you can viably recover. And that's where I think the point of non-viability as concept sort of enters, because I think one of the things I would say firms need to think about in their recovery plan is, particularly if you're a capital constrained firm, most firms are capital constrained, or at least they're capital and liquidity constrained, is what is it that breaks you? And can you recover from that point within your own means without having to do something? Is that a concept you'd agree with?
So I remember all those conversations about the point of non-viability fondly. I think you're absolutely right. And it's for me, it's actually quite important that firms define, or at least attempt to define, what that point of non-viability is. And I do like that analogy, where recovery is where you're starting to nosedive, the plane is going, and then you manage to take back control. And just before you get to that point of non-viability, which I assume in your analogy is the ground, but just before that, you actually get that back. So really understanding what that point of non-viability is, have you got recovery options, enough capacity in there to actually allow you to recover and take back to the air? And I think likewise, when you're talking about resolution, you're going past the point of non-viability. And again, I would stress the importance of firms understanding what that point is, because it's not defined anywhere by the Bank of England or the PRA.
So that's entirely within the firm's judgment.
It is.
That is for the board to determine as to, okay, what are we solving to here? So the link with risk appetite has to be massive.
Yes, indeed. And actually setting that risk appetite. And again, we've talked long and hard about what does a recovery risk appetite look like? Is there a minimum CET1, or is there a minimum LCR that we get to? And indeed, from a capacity perspective, what is the minimum amount of capacity that our recovery options will allow us to rebuild? So from that point, can we actually build up enough capital, or indeed liquidity,
and keep the bank running?
Yes.
Keep the bank or the building society running whilst all these things are going on, and it's an incredibly stressful period. We'll come back to recovery capacity in a second. What we've talked about here is a scenario where you get into trouble and you have to do something about it. But we all like to think we're guardians of the balance sheet and that we would take action before things got out of hand. And that normally happens through the use of early warning indicators. So let's talk a little bit about the role early warning indicators play, but also how you overlay and, I guess, backtest them through the stress scenarios that you're running.
For me, a robust early warning indicator process is crucial to actually management being able to identify the start of that. Again, strong governance, etc. But if we're talking about early warning indicators here, what you're wanting is, what are the symptoms that you'd see that would suggest you're getting into capital stress? So, for example, that would mean losing CET1 very quickly over the planning period. You've got liquidity. what level of outflows would you need to see before you started to get worried? Again, operational, what kind of operational events? Is there anything that we're seeing internally from our stats that suggests that we may be heading for some big losses operationally, or indeed financial crime that we're beginning to be a target where we're going to have big losses there? And then the credit assessment, and then also the reputational. And this probably one which is quite difficult to calibrate your EWI framework. How do you determine when things are getting a little bit worse? Because if we think about all the failures or near bank failures that we've had in the UK in our lifetime, the press has played an important part of that.
Well, and social media now, right?
Yeah, exactly. So monitoring your Twitter account, monitor what your customers are saying. All of that MI is really crucial to understand if we're heading for a stress. But the one thing I would say, and it's something that's very, very pertinent to me at the moment, is how many should you have in your EWI framework?
That's a great question, because you and I, again, we've lots of debate around this, because if you look at the list that you're required to look at, it's quite a long list.
No, exactly. And that EBA list of minimum requirements isn't exhaustive by any means. So you've really got to understand what things matter to you. What is a so what with all of these? And I would almost say you want to have your Premier League, the EWIs. If you start tripping into those, you've really got something to worry about. Down to your maybe first division, second division, whereby if they start tripping in isolation, doesn't really matter. But if you start seeing a number of these and the knock-on impact, might have a knock-on impact and cumulatively impact one of those more important ones. So I think it's really, really important to have a think of what EWIs you want to track and make them manageable, because if you've got an EWI list of 70, 80, or even over 100, how are the board and management?
That was going to be my point. How does anybody make sense of that many?
No, exactly. So you've really got to focus in on what matters to you. When do you actually start getting worried, and make sure your EWIs are detailed enough that you would see any impact?
Just let me get this sort in your head. It's a bit like a pyramid. Whilst you can look at a lot of different indicators, ultimately they're going to result in a handful of ones that are really
correct,
basically. Because if you think about capital, you could have 10 or 20 different indicators that all basically either push an RWA number or push a CET1 number a particular way. So they're all interlinked anyway. I mean, one on their own won't make a difference necessarily, but a combination of them in quick order creates a problem.
Very much. And that triangle analogy is actually quite helpful to have a think about, or the way I think about it, rather, where the top of the triangle are the EWIs that the board and senior management should be worried about. And then as you get further down the triangle is where more of the operational teams can worry about, is there anything here we should be worried about that we should be pushing up to the senior manager? So I think that is quite good. But for me, setting those EWIs and knowing exactly what you would do if those trigger, and what levels would you start taking action? So, and that's where you come into your recovery plan levels. If some of them start tripping, you're in heightened awareness, you monitor MI, you make sure that you're taking what actions, and you're maybe preparing to take some of the more difficult actions that you would do. But knowing when to start planning those is actually critical for that senior management team.
And presumably what you're trying to do is reflect that in the stress scenarios you're running to make sure that they're being calibrated correctly, yeah?
Correct. When you're in the stress testing, so while it's a desktop exercise, you're not in a live situation, what constantly you're wanting to look at these hypothetical events, what EWIs are tripping, just to back test, have we got these calibrated correctly? And number one, and number two, do we have the correct EWIs? Because if you're not tripping anything and we're in a stress, then that suggests something isn't quite working. And again, that's the importance of stress testing, that constant back-checking, understanding what you would actually do in that situation.
Can I come back round to my dearly beloved colleagues in second and third line. Right. So clearly, as with any sort of process you go through, you want strong controls.
Yes.
And you've already said this is led by Treasury, or certainly it's delivered by first line.
Yes.
So what roles do second and third line play? I mean, you've made the jump from first line to second line, so you know all the first line secrets.
Yes. Indeed. And given my current role, it'd be foolish of me to say that the second and third line weren't crucial. But I do think they do play a really important part in this. I think, first and foremost, I think the real value that second and third line can bring to these discussions is taking that high-level helicopter view. So you've got your first line in the detail, delivering on what the regulatory requirements for what you need in recovery and resolution planning. They're actually looking at what options you've got and making sure that you've got a playbook and you understand what steps you would take to undertake that. I think the key role for a second and third line is maybe to take a step back.
Yep.
And would this actually work in practice?
Is this the document you would literally pull off the shelf and sort of break the glass and actively use if it's like a, I don't know, 200, maybe 1,000, 2,000 page document? How usable is it, right?
And that's exactly it. So if you think about the amount of documentation we produce in ILAPs, ICAPs, recovery plans, RAF documentation, etc., I heard an analogy that if you printed it all off, it would probably be taller than a human being. And technology has allowed us to do that because we don't no longer print everything off now. So we've just allowed these documents to get bigger and bigger. But in terms of the second and third line of defense, rather, how would this feel for a board member? Would this give them the clear roles and responsibilities, the actions that they need to do if they were ever faced with that? Likewise, those individuals in management with roles and responsibilities, would this documentation actually help you actually deliver? So, for example, the CEO, would the OCIR playbook and the RAF, would that actually give you the information that you would actually need to operate the business? Valuations, the CFO, would the playbooks actually give a step-by-step guide as to what a finance function would need to do to actually pull together? So I think that's really where the second and third line can add value. Any oversight assurance that needs to be outcomes-based. So is the governance in place to enable those decision makers to take those decisions in a timely manner? Do we know how we would execute any of those actions? Do we have the experience of doing some of this type of stuff? Because if you think about some of the restructuring plans, there may well be restructuring options in there that the bank has never even considered in BAU. Therefore, how likely would it be that it would be able to pull these actions off? Finally, I think the key thing is the first line actually adequately tested? Are the first line looking at their documentation and providing as real-life tests as they possibly can in order to be able to do that? So I think that's the action second and third line should be looking at when they're doing their work. I don't know if you've got any views coming from having not been in second or third line.
I will answer your question by not answering it and throwing a question back at you. But it is moving on to an important topic, which is where I think about this a lot is if you work through the policy statements around either recovery or resolution, right? You tick all the boxes. Have we met this requirement? Tick, 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 tick. But ultimately, you made a really important point is how does board or a leadership team actually use this in earnest? And the first question is, how should a board determine whether a recovery plan actually works? And this sort of stems into recovery capacity.
Yeah.
What is recovery capacity? Because it's not a mandated thing within the regulatory framework, but it is an area that regulators ask firms a lot about. What is recovery capacity and how should firms think about setting it? And is it just one metric or is it lots of other metrics?
So for me, recovery capacity is very much, if you were to deploy all of the actions that you can take in a recovery scenario, how much capital would you be able to do? So say you've got a firm there that would look to offload books of assets, potentially look at raising capital through private placements or in the open market if there's still trust, although I think we've had many conversations that that would be very likely. But for me, recovery capacity is very much, if you're to deploy those actions that you think are actually feasible and could be done in a recovery situation, how much CET1 would you be able to put onto the balance sheet? And likewise, in liquidity, how much liquidity capacity can you raise by deploying those options? So for me, it kind of comes back to that recovery risk appetite. When you're sitting there as a board, how much CET1 or indeed LCR, how much would you want as a board as a minimum for your recovery options to bring back? And it's really understanding that is going to be the key as to whether you have enough capacity or not.
Can I tug on this a little bit, right?
Yeah.
I don't think you're saying you need to get back to the point you were at before you experienced problems. Is there an interim step that you're looking to get to? Is that kind of what you're saying?
You're absolutely correct. There's no reason to get back to where you were. What we're saying is we've got enough capacity in our recovery options to actually be a viable entity again.
Which presumably means some form of re-establishing market confidence.
Correct. And the way we've talked about it a lot is initially you're wanting to get everything that you can to re-establish that credibility in the market, such that in a future date, you will be able to go back to the market for capital or securitization funding, etc., where the market then has confidence in you. So there's definitely an interim state. How much capital or liquidity do you want to get back to that will allow you to continue in business and actually give you a platform to build that credibility back up again?
Basically, go big, go hard, go early.
Yep.
But that may mean some pretty tough choices to make. But isn't that what leadership teams and boards are supposed to be doing in that scenario? Because you don't want to have to keep on coming back and say, here's plan B, or no, here's plan C. You want to go at it reasonably hard so you can rebuild that credibility.
Exactly. I know we're talking about recovery here, but if you look at the restructuring plan and the business reorganization plan, which is part of the RAF and the restructuring barrier, that is key. And you'll have seen that with the banks that got into trouble in the GFC. When they applied for state aid, they had to produce that recovery plan. And in that, there was publicly available metrics and hurdles that you would have to get to over time to, again, establish that credibility in the market. So in plan A, this is what we're going to do. And here are the milestones. Here is how long it's going to take to get us able to build back X percent of CET1. And by putting those milestones in place, you're actually able to tell the market, yes, this management team knows exactly what they're doing. They're delivering on the plan that they've set out and got agreement with. And by demonstrating that you're able to continue to deliver and meet your milestones, should put you in a position where you can build that credibility in the market.
I've got another area where I think it's an important area of judgment. And if you think about stress scenarios, the problem is nobody has perfect foresight. So nobody knows which stress scenario is going to knock you over. But equally, sometimes regulation, for very good reasons, wants you to sort of define clearly what a scenario is. But not every recovery action works in every single scenario. What's your sort of thinking around rigid versus more flexible frameworks for how firms can think about, we've got this particular problem, clearly we hadn't foreseen it. Should you be setting a more flexible framework in terms of the choices firms can make, or should it be a bit more rigid around, we'll always deploy this option because it's a great option? How do you think about that?
First thing I say on that is guaranteed the stress event that will trip you up will be something that you've never thought about before. Otherwise, you'd have planned for it and you'd been able to cope with it. That, to me, talks about being as flexible as possible, because the actual details of the scenario that is going to happen will not be what actually happens, and you need to deploy those. But it's interesting, you said, are there any options that you would deploy immediately, regardless of what scenario is? So what I would say is some of your options may fall into that category. If you've got a liquidity stress, what do you want to do? You want to make sure you maximize the liquidity that you've got in your balance sheet. So if customers want their money back, you've got that money to pay. So things like utilizing your Bank of England balance, selling those HQLAs and converting those into cash, that makes sense, because what you're doing is making sure that you're maximizing the amount of cash you've got in your balance sheet and increasing the chances of your survival long enough for you to actually put in place some of the longer term actions. So things like selling book of assets, etc. That's going to take time. That's not going to happen overnight. So I think it's very, very important when you're thinking about your recovery options. What are those recovery options you can deploy day one that actually buys you that time? And what are the recovery options that takes a bit more thought and actually being able to decide if this is the right thing for the future of the book? Because let's face it, if you're selling assets, depending on what assets you're selling and the price you obviously get, they may not increase your capital, or you may not get a lot of liquidity from them. So for me, you want a framework that is flexible as possible and is able to adapt to what the specifics of that scenario. But at the same time, you do want some recovery actions that you can play quickly in order to buy you that time to make those tougher decisions.
If I can just come in there, those tougher decisions that you make, again, given recovery plans, the responsibility of the leadership team, making sure that, you know, you're looking at this, what's the customer impact, right? What's the franchise impact? What's the reputational impact? All of these sorts of things, you know, can we actually do this from a technology point of view? Is that what you're meaning by that sort of more careful thought?
Exactly. Because you've got to remember, this isn't just a treasury stress. This is a bank-wide stress. This is putting your survival. So the aim is to create a long-term viable entity. Therefore, any decisions that you've got to make, you've got to think of in terms of, what does this do to the franchise? What are customers going to think of us if we take this action? So that if we do manage to recover, we've actually got a franchise that is able to build back that credibility and actually be long-term viable. Because it's all very good, recovery options buying you the time, but if you aren't able to then use that time to become a credible entity again, say for example, you've annoyed all your customers, so the customers don't want to be with you, that puts some stress on the viability of the franchise again. So you're absolutely spot on. It's about understanding the impacts over all the stakeholders at play when you're making these decisions.
I'm going to come to my final question, and I'm going to try and sort of take everything we've talked about over this episode and sort of try and bring it together. And it's the final area for where I think your thoughts around guidance to firms, which is, how do you bring this together at a practical level? And I'm really talking about the role of testing and assurance. You've touched on that, but also the nature of, I guess, what, let's call them fire drills.
Yeah.
Can you give us your thoughts there as to what good looks like for those areas?
So in terms of fire drills and testing assurance, what good looks like, ultimately in all these things, you want to get lessons learned. You want to understand where your shortcomings are. If you go into a fire drill and you come out saying, yeah, we're great, everything's working perfectly, you failed. But in terms of what do you need for a successful fire drill, number one is you need the right people in the room. So as close to how you would run a crisis as possible. So say in your recovery plan, you've got a recovery and resolution committee set up to make these difficult decisions, and that's clearly spelled out in that. That's who you want in the room for a fire drill. And then fire drills can be either targeted in a specific area, for example, running evaluations and restructuring options, or operational continuity, or indeed, if it's that board level members, you might want to have the operational aspect, the capital and liquidity stresses, and making sure that you take the actions in an appropriate way. Fire drills can be, I guess, targeted on specific areas, and that might involve some of the lower down operation people that will actually deliver the operational aspects of it, getting them in a room, understand what they're doing, go away, actually running that, right up to the high level, let's get everyone that's on that recovery and resolution committee in a room whereby we talk about what actions we would like to take. It may be that you split the fire drill into two sessions. One where you think about, right, here's the situation we're in. Here's the recovery options that we want to look at. Then end it there where you're looking to rank the recovery options. What recovery options would you like to do first and foremost? And then go away, allow the operational teams to model that and work out what that would look like in terms of the balance sheet, and then reconvene that committee again with MI and information that have been produced by the operational teams. You can actually make a defined decision based on those strong risk appetite metrics that you've set in terms of recovery. So we want to make sure that we recover X percent of CT1, or we want to build X billion pounds of liquidity into the balance sheet. So in answer to your question, it is very difficult to say, what does a perfect fire drill look like? The key thing here is defining straight up what you're wanting to test. Are you wanting to test the high level capability? Or are you wanting to test a detailed operational aspect of it? Once you've decided that, get the right people in the room and define what you're looking to achieve on that, and just let it run and see if we are actually able to come to those decisions that we predefined. And in saying that, you also want to uncover lessons learned, the thing that I said right at the beginning. Because if you're running an exercise and there's nothing learned, then it's a waste of time.
Let me give you an example. I ran a scenario once with the leadership team.
Yep.
And the CEO asked two questions. This is at its simplest level. He looked at each member of the LT and asked them to recite what their responsibilities were as it related to recovery. But you know, this was a recovery into resolution scenario. So what are your responsibilities? Your SMFs, what are your responsibilities? And the second point he said is, okay, what MI do we have to make decisions on the basis that this is a fast-moving situation? Do we have the right MI? And I think from both of those, we then took that away and said, actually, we've learned a load. But that was a reasonably simple type exercise, but it made you think really, really hard. Well, what information, to your point from earlier, is this the document you pull off the shelf and reach for? Actually, this was on two pages. Can I have an explanation of what the problem is? So in this case, it was liquidity, so payment stress. So what's the payment queue looking like? And then in order of priority, what are the liquidity resources I have available, and in what order do I deploy them?
Correct.
Almost intraday. And that was a really important test. So I totally agree with everything you've said there. Can we finish off and talking about good testing and assurance?
Yeah. And just before we get onto that, in a separate organization, I've been in a very similar situation where we've sat around a room with the leadership team, and it wasn't quite the CEO pointing at everyone saying, what's your responsibilities? But that was effectively the way I ran that scenario, and asking each individual member of the exco, what are their responsibilities and what would they do in this situation? And that really plays home. Do these people get it? Do they understand what they would do? But to answer your question about what does good test and assurance look like, first and foremost is in the planning. You absolutely need to understand what you're looking to test and what does good look like. And I think if you don't define that up front, there's a good chance you're not going to get what you need out of that. So for me, a lot of it is in the planning. Take, for example, valuations, whereby the finance teams are modelling the impact of any decisions that you're making. I guess it's to your point earlier, it's about the MI and actually being able to provide the people within that test with the MI that they can make decisions. The other thing I would say is, if you can do testing in real life, there is no better test.
Yeah.
If you're sitting there, you say that you can sell a book of mortgages, for example, and you go away and actually deliver on that, you've proven that you've got the capabilities in BAU, and therefore you should have the capabilities if you needed them in a recovery and resolution situation. What I'm trying to get at is testing is...
regular and often?
Obviously regular and often, and that really, for me, that is where second and third line can come in, whereby they're looking at the control environment, they're constantly testing the control environment, making sure that that is fine. And also regular and often as well, to keep this fresh in people's mind.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, recovery and resolution is a subject that no one really wants to talk about.
Well, no one ever wants to experience it either.
Yeah, we hope we'll never experience it. Therefore, when the topic comes up, is there a tendency just to, yeah, we're nice and safe, we don't need to worry about that. But the evidence shows, because these stress events do happen.
Yeah.
I mean, we all had GFC back in 2008, 2009. And just as it was beginning to be talked about in history, last year you had SVB and the problems with a number of banks. So this is a real and present danger. Therefore, doing regular tests just keeps it front of mind, and it really helps you to focus in on what you need to improve. The more you can learn from your testing that improves things in BAU, improves efficiency, etc., the better, because again, that keeps it live in mind and lets people see the value of that testing in recovery and resolution.
One final thought for you, Kevin, right, to wrap up this episode. Anybody having responsibility for recovery and resolution, what's the most important learning you would give them?
For me, it's how will this work in real life? Do you actually know what you would do in terms of managing the balance sheet, the operational aspect of keeping the lights on, and then solving what you need to build a credible bank? So for me, liquidity is key for that short-term survival. Operational is key for making sure the lights stay on and you keep servicing your customers. And then capital for a longer-term view to be able to create a long-term viable bank. And if you nail those three things and bring them together in a nice summarized document that everyone understands, and the board and Exco are comfortable that they know what they would actually do, you're on to a winner. If you're just treating it as a compliance exercise, you're not going to be ready if it really happens.
I think that was more than one thing. I think that was four. So I think you've been overly generous, which is very untreasury-like in handing out more ideas than the sort of ones you've been asked for. I agree. At the end of the day, a recovery and resolution plan has to be both usable and deliverable. And I think those are the two things. So I'm going to go for two as opposed to your four, but I don't disagree with everything you said. Kevin, thank you very much for taking part in this episode and for giving us your thoughts on this. And I'm really glad that you've been able to write the chapter on recovery and resolution for the cert balm. I know I've been talking about this for a few years, so I'm glad we're now adding that capability into the cert balm. And thank you again for taking part.
No, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Treasury Matters. We hope you enjoyed it. Look out for more episodes coming from us soon. And in the meantime, why don't you follow us on your favourite podcast app?